CataractCoach.com. Welcome to our podcast. Today's episode number 16. That's with Dr. Marguerite McDonald. Dr. McDonald is a true innovator, leader, educator in ophthalmology. Yes, you may know her as the first surgeon on the planet to use an excimer laser to ablate the cornea for keratorefractive purposes. But she's done many other firsts as well. But even more important is the story behind it. Do you know how many little things had to happen, some almost by luck, to come together just so that we could have excimer lasers now in our clinics to do LASIK or surface ablation? And speaking of which, why does Dr. Marguerite McDonald now prefer surface ablation over LASIK? And what's her secret recipe? She reveals it all. It's an incredibly entertaining, informative, educational podcast. I learned so much. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Check it out. So welcome back to our weekly Cataract Coach podcast. And today we're talking to Dr. Marguerite McDonald, who's absolutely one of the leaders in ophthalmology, especially when it comes to anything refractive surgery. The first surgeon on the planet to use an excimer laser to ablate a cornea, and many other firsts in the field too. She's won every possible award from every major organization, and she has a tremendous amount of knowledge and experience to share, and I bet we're going to learn a lot. So, Marguerite, welcome, and thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Uday. It is a huge honor and pleasure for me to be invited by you, who, by the way, listeners, was recently voted number 2 in the top ophthalmologists in the United States.
Yeah, well deserved. Thank you. Like I said, my mom said, why wasn't I number 1? And she reminded me that I got a B+ in 8th grade. So I don't think I can ever be good enough for my own mom, but thank you. That's a big honor for me. But what's really impressive about you is you're so incredibly humble and approachable. And you have a history of really mentoring the next generation of ophthalmologists, which to me is the most endearing. What also interests me is that you were the first surgeon on the planet to do excimer laser ablations. And tell me what that was like. So you did med school at Columbia, Ivy League med school, an amazing med school. You did your residency at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat. Again, one of the top programs. And then how did you decide to go to LSU with Herb Kaufman to learn refractive surgery or corneal surgery?
Well, Herb Kaufman was at the time the top cornea specialist in the world. People were flying in on private jets from all over the world to have him do their corneal surgery. He was cutting edge on everything. When he was 26, without any virology background, he invented the first antiviral drug in ophthalmology.
Wow.
He landed on the cover of Time magazine when he was 26 years old.
Wow, that's amazing.
When he was a resident at Mass Eye and Ear, the University of Florida came to him and said, sir, when you finish your training, would you come be our chairman? Yeah.
Whoa. From finishing your training to chairman?
Yes. And he did. He accepted it. So he was just an extraordinary person. And I applied for the fellowship. I was extremely lucky to get it. And the magic of his department, if I could take a sidebar here.
Sure.
He had MDs and PhDs assigned to pods. So if you were interested in cornea and cornea research, you were all together in one area and you used the same water fountain and you used the same everything. You saw each other nonstop. Most departments keep their PhDs in a separate building, and they're not even invited to faculty meeting. Kaufman underpaid the MDs a little, so he could overpay the PhDs a little, according to the growing scale, you know, whatever the scale was at the time. So that they would be equals.
Parity.
Yes. The MDs got a window in their office. The PhDs got a window in their lab. Everything was parity. And because the PhDs felt equal to us, we all talked and had great research ideas and worked together. And some of us even married each other. I married Dr. Steve Kleiss. But you know, it was just a magical place to be. And when I arrived there, Kaufman had just given the Jackson Memorial Lecture, and he was the subject of great criticism because he gave it on the topic of epicardophakia, which it was the living contact lens, and he had like three or four patients who were 2 weeks post-op. And he got a lot of criticism for doing that. And when I arrived, he said, Marguerite, you're going to help me make this work. We're going to make epicardophakia work. And only older ophthalmologists remember this, but epicardophakia, we taught hundreds of people internationally how to do it. AMO made little corneal lenticles that were ground to the patient's prescription. You could order a toric lens. You could order -4 +350 at 75 degrees. We would make it, freeze dry it, ship it to the surgeon. They poured BSS on it. It fluffed up and they sewed it on the front of the eye after removing the epithelium. So I stepped into the middle of this wonderful, exciting department, and I was honored to play a big role in epicardophakia. As a matter of fact, I still have some of the boxes that are from AMO that are labeled KME, the Kaufman-McDonald epicardophakia procedure.
Wow.
And that was a kind of a crazy thing for, here I was in my 20s still, and I'm looking at rooms full of gray-haired surgeons, no women, and going all over the world teaching this. So, of course, it got replaced by other technologies. It took 6 weeks for the lenticles to clear in an adult human. Luckily, only 2 weeks in infants, so it was very useful for pediatric aphakia.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, they cleared like this, and the results were terrific. And they were removable, reversible, repeatable. So, but eventually other technologies replace it, but it was great. So at about the same time, we became one of the PERC centers for the prospective evaluation of radiokeratotomy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I was honored to be the PERC surgeon. So through real luck, I ended up in this hotbed of refractive surgery. And it was just a joy. I mean, I worked very, very hard, but like all fellows do, but it was just amazing. People were flying in on a weekly basis, doctors from all over, to watch us do RK, to learn more about epicardophakia.
Sure. Wow. And you said you even had patients flying in from all over the planet, too, basically.
Yeah. And they had been doing that for years for Dr. Kaufman. Yes, absolutely.
So how did you go from you're doing epicardophakia, you're doing the RK study, the PERC study, where did excimer lasers come from? I don't actually know. What was the birth of excimer lasers in the U.S. or worldwide?
Great question. I was not long out of my fellowship, but in the middle of all this epicardophakia, RK stuff in the department, and I read Dr. Steve Troquel's landmark 1983 paper in the AJO, and he had taken an excimer laser from Silicon Valley, a little laser that was used to make silicone chips, and he just shot randomly some lines, some incisions across pig and cow cadaver eyes, cadaver corneas. No attempt at a refractive correction. He just strafed these corneas and said, look at this. It's possible to make incisions in the cornea without thermal damage. So I said, oh my gosh. And I called him up and I said, do you remember me? When I was at Columbia Medical School, which is where Dr. Troquel is located still, when I was at medical school, I asked him to give me aqueous humor from his cataract surgeries that served as the control for my retinoblastoma studies. I said, remember me? You helped me with my retinoblastoma research a few years ago. You need monkeys. The vivarium on the Upper West Side at Columbia has like 3 monkeys, 2 rabbits. You need lots and lots of animals. I have lots of animals. I am down at LSU now. And, I'd love to work with you and Dr. Munnerlin. So it was the three of us. We became like the three legs of a stool.
Wow. So after your fellowship at LSU, they loved you so much. They didn't let you leave.
No, they were kind enough to offer me a job, and I stayed there. I stayed there for a very long time. And, this is long before any advanced technology. I'm not even sure we had fax machines then. We certainly, you know, had the phone, and that was about it, and snail mail. So Charles Mundelin in California, Steve Troquel in Manhattan, and myself at LSU in New Orleans, we worked together. We were on the phone day and night. They would frequently fly down. First, we did countless plastic discs.
Okay.
Then we did cadaver animal eyes. Then we did living animals. And I must say, the rabbits came first, and my goodness, they did not do well at first. They did not do well. We knew nothing about laser vision correction at that time, of course. Nobody did. Mm-hmm. So we shot at the rabbits from 6 feet away.
Wow, okay.
From 6 feet away. And we had a diaphragm that had five positions, and I cranked it closed by hand. So we'd shoot for a few seconds. Marguerite would go crank, crank, crank. Then we'd shoot for a few more seconds. So there was a stepped ablation with five big steps. Of course, we didn't know smoother was better. We didn't know this.
Sure.
And the rabbits developed these thick, hyperplastic white scars. It was horrible.
Oh.
In one week, excuse me, in 1 week, we had my research coordinator and my cornea fellow both quit. They said, this project is a loser. We're out of here.
Oh, my goodness.
That was pretty grim. So we had a conference call about this, and I said to Charles and Steve, you know, let's, before we throw in the towel, let's try something else. And I honestly don't remember which one of us came up with it, maybe all three of us, but we said, let's try making the ablation smoother. Let's see if that matters. So Charles rigged the hand crank to close automatically in 40 steps.
Oh, instead of five.
Instead of five. So 40 steps now looks incredibly crude to us, but at the time, the rabbits got a lot better. And we said, you know, maybe there's something to the smoothness bit here. So,
and this is just scraping off epithelium and going right into the stroma.
Right. It was PRK. It was PRK. And by the way, after Troquel's paper, there were two or three research groups around the world that popped up doing eczema research also, but they spent years doing RK. We did RK research for about 2 days, and we realized that was not the proper use of the eczema laser.
Sure.
And moved on to surface ablation immediately. So the rabbits looked better. We decided to move on to monkeys. Meanwhile, we're submitting all this data to the FDA, and the FDA was not happy with us. They said, why are you doing this? You're firing a laser at the visual axis of people who don't like their glasses. Why aren't you doing diabetic retinopathy research? Why aren't you doing glaucoma research? This is silly and dangerous. And that was the prevailing view, let me tell you. It was swimming upstream. We were considered silly and dangerous people. So I actually got an NIH grant to study this. And there were people complaining that the federal government should not be giving money for this kind of research. But anyway, we got to the monkeys. We did so many monkeys, and the results were getting better and better, and we were making the ablation smoother and smoother. So we do a bunch of monkeys, submit the data, retinoscopy, pathology, and the results were amazing, but the FDA said, do more monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Do more monkeys. So I really thought we'd be doing monkeys forever when we got a call from the Oculoplastic Service at LSU, and they said, we have a 62-year-old woman here. She has a perfectly healthy 20/20 eye, uncorrected, that she's about to lose during an exoneration for orbital melanoma. And we're going to do her exoneration in a few days, but she has volunteered to let someone experiment on this eye before she loses it.
Oh.
At just
so there's no downside.
No, and here she is facing absolute, you know, disfigurement.
Sure.
And they told her probable death anyway, but this was her only shot. And in the middle of all that grief, she made this extraordinary offer. So the FDA said, you can do it. So we took her out to the primate center, past all the monkeys who were spitting and shrieking at her.
Uh-huh.
And we laid her down under the laser, and she was a 2020 Plano. This was an eye that needed no correction. And we made her 4.5 diopters hyperopic. We did a 4.5 diopter myopic ablation.
Wow.
And of course, she was uncomfortable because we didn't know much about pain control back then. So we made her blurry and uncomfortable, and we followed her every single day. And we did retinoscopy, and we did topography, and we did everything. And we got the specimen afterward, and we gave it all to the FDA, and they finally said, okay, you can start the blind eye clinical trial in humans. So Mrs. Cassidy, her name was Alberta Cassidy. She let us use her name. She died of metastatic melanoma 6 months later.
Oh, my goodness.
But we got permission from LSU to name our humble little laser trailer the Alberta Cassidy Excimer Laser Laboratory. And it was a big fight because the university said, we only name things after people who give us a lot of money. I said, what else could she give us? What more could this lady have given us? So we owe a lot to Alberta Cassidy. Anyway, the university wouldn't let us bring the laser across the lake from Lake Pontchartrain from the Primate Center into the medical school because they were afraid it would leak and the gas would kill everyone. So we...
Okay.
So we, okay. We were allowed to put it in a trailer, the one that was named after Alberta Cassidy. So we were in a trailer right outside the medical school and next to the trash compactor.
Oh, gosh. The prime real estate.
So the whole area stunk to high heaven. And We'd be in the middle of doing surgery, and all of a sudden our trailer would shake because the trash compactor was starting up.
Oh, my goodness.
I went nuts. I went out and I said, you can't, when you see this little red flag up, that means we're operating here. You can't operate the trash compactor. And they were union guys. They said, we have to stay on a schedule. I went to the dean. I went to everyone and I said, I'm going to show you what damage you're doing. We're going to analyze the data from the patients that were operated when the trash compactor was operating and the people when they were, you know, in a silent room that wasn't shaking without the trash compactor. And much to my surprise, the trash compactor patients did better.
What?
Why? Because it was making it smoother.
Oh,
all that gentle shaking. So we thought we had figured out the smooth thing. No. You can't make it smooth enough. It's not possible to make the ablation. So I stopped complaining. I let them turn on the compactor anytime they wanted, and we increased the number of steps. And, of course, as we moved through the blind eyes, the partially sighted eyes with myopia, then myopic astigmatism, then hyperopia, as we moved through each group,
sure,
we got smoother and smoother ablations. We moved to flying spots, of course, mm-hmm. and the rest is history.
Well, the crazy part is that how many things had to kind of happen, oftentimes by serendipity, just for this to have succeeded.
Yes. You know, if I've often said if it weren't for Alberta Cassidy, we might still be doing monkeys.
Right?
It was that crazy. There were angry editorials. One of the most famous living ophthalmologists at the time wrote an editorial in a very famous peer-reviewed journal that attacked me personally and said I was lying and making up data.
What?
Yeah, and that it was unethical to do this kind of thing, and I'm lying. It was rough. You had to have very thick skin. Very thick
wow,
skin.
Wow, that's no joke. Yeah, I mean, I guess sometimes the current dogma takes a long time to change, right? A decade or two prior, that's when everyone said that IOLs were bad. IOLs were a ticking time bomb in the eye was the quote, right?
And poor Charlie Kelman.
Right.
Poor Charlie Kelman. How he was, you know, He was fried. He was fried by the doctors at the time by the status quo. So, but it was all worth it. You're right. There were many little twists of fate along the way, but really, you know, I there are times when I've said we should call all this the Cassidy procedures.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, I mean, really, that's how much she contributed to medicine. The way we practice medicine.
Especially the story about the trash compactor, and then therefore, as it shook the bed or shook the laser, it smoothed out the ablation. Wow, that's just, you would have never known otherwise.
You know, we thought, okay, when we went to 5 to 40, okay, that's good, 40, that's good. No, it has to be infinitely smooth.
Is there still a role then for broad beam lasers? There's still broad beam lasers available, or should we only be using flying spot to have a much smoother ablation? I don't know the answer.
Really, it's flying spots. There is no way to make, in my opinion, I don't think there is a way to make a closing diaphragm smooth enough. Maybe engineers could take another look at it, but the flying spots are the way to go. And, of course, there are multiple flying spots now, so the ablations don't take a long time.
Yeah, laser. I mean, obviously, the evolution of lasers is amazing, of excimer lasers. So that's changed a tremendous amount. Why do you think there's a big resistance then? Like, I would think that getting an excimer laser ablation would be like getting braces. Like, every 12 or 13-year-old child in America, or almost, many of them, get braces to have straight teeth later in life. Wouldn't you just say, okay, 22-year-old, you're done with your schooling, your myopia is stabilized, let's do your LASIK or PRK?
I thought that would happen. I thought every child in a middle-class family that could afford it would give them their braces at 11 and their laser vision correction at 22. I thought that would happen. And it didn't. And I've given it a lot of thought. I think mostly it's because every few years there's an extremely negative LASIK story that hits the media. Extremely negative.
Right.
And sometimes you do have to wonder about the motivation of the people who are releasing these stories.
Sure.
It's been carefully studied. There is no more successful elective surgical procedure in the world than laser vision correction. Of course, it's expensive. And I think we did ourselves a lot of damage early on with the price wars.
Sure.
I think that wasn't good. You know, plastic surgeons never did that. Plastic surgeons never engaged in price wars with each other.
Yeah.
And right through recessions, 2008, they kept their prices, and it held them in good stead. They fared much better than we did. But saying, come to my place, you know, a starting price, $700, and there were a lot of seminars at night with free pina coladas, and there was some marketing stuff that was, you know.
Yeah, maybe not the best decision there.
But I think the price wars are pretty much over. Everybody has stabilized, and most people are sort of within the same range. So thank God that's in the past, but I hope we all learned a lesson from that. I really think the number one reason that LASIK isn't performed on every 22-year-old who has finished school is the negative media every few years. There's some big story. And it goes, you know, worldwide.
Yeah, it seems like you're right. Every couple of years, there's some big story about like the newscaster woman who was depressed and kills herself. And I never saw the relationship between why would the LASIK cause her to kill herself? But you're right. Even recently, I think someone sent me some New York Times article recently, or Washington Post article very recently, about the same kind of negative press about it. For a procedure that is, like you said, out of any elective surgery head to toe, the highest success rate.
You know, it's interesting. the boomers that had it done, even though they accessed the technology when it was very early in the game, right after FDA approval, and where the trackers weren't as good as they are now, nothing was as good as it was now. Those people were happy, and their kids, their kids want LASIK.
Yeah.
Mom and dad had LASIK, you know?
Right.
Do you find that? Do you find that in your...
I did the math. 22% of my cataract surgery patients have had prior LASIK or PRK. 22%.
Yeah.
So it's a huge segment of my population, sure, that had 20-some years ago, even 25, 28 years ago, had early, early days of LASIK. And they said it was amazing for 20 years until they got cataracts.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to really get them to think. A lot of them have forgotten. They have forgotten that they had laser vision correction. And with time, it gets harder and harder to see that flap. A 28-year-old flap is really hard to see. Thank God most of those cases can be picked up with topography.
Yeah,
you
for
see
sure.
That you, there's the big blue spot. Oh, were you nearsighted before your LASIK? You know?
Yeah, they often forget, especially like if they had PRK, you see no evidence of it.
No evidence.
But you say, wait a minute, your actual length is 26 and your keratometry is 38. Wait a minute.
Yep.
Kind of makes you think a second. You know, we also have a society where we are so dependent on our phones, iPads, devices. I see small babies in strollers playing on iPads.
Yes.
And I think we're going to go the way of like Singapore and Hong Kong, where you see like 80% of young people being myopic. So there's going to be a greater and greater need for having vision correction.
They predict a tsunami of myopia because of this. Kids don't go outside and play. They don't look off in the distance. They're looking within 18 to 22 inches of their face. Yeah.
Yeah, for like 6, 7, 8, 10 hours a day. Huge numbers. And now even for the young kids, schoolwork is all computer, laptop-based, iPad-based, et cetera. So it's crazy that we're not more accepting of a procedure. Like, I think LASIK now, LASIK and PRK combined is still less than $1 million a year.
Yeah, I know.
While in the U.S. we do 4 million cataracts a year.
I know. Yeah. With cataracts, though, you know, when you finally lose your driver's license, I mean, they're, you know... if you choose not to have LASIK, you will not lose your driver's license. Cataracts are a full stop, you know. That forces people. And even if they choose to have no femto, no premium IOL, you know, it is covered by insurance, so.
Yeah, I guess that's an issue for it too, certainly. But, you know, if you look at it from another perspective, I mean, you wear glasses or contacts for 10 years, that's already more than the cost of doing the laser vision correction.
Actually, Herb Kaufman, once again, about 10 years into the popularity of laser vision correction, you know, maybe in the mid to late 90s, he wrote this fantastic editorial for the AJO where he said, the risk of contacts goes up every year. As you get older, your eyes get drier. You develop exposure keratitis, nocturnal lagophthalmos. All these bad things start to happen to your eyes that increase the risk of contacts. Whereas laser vision correction, one and done. That's it. No increased risk. It was much better written than that, and it had references. but it was a fantastic editorial that got a lot of attention.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So what are the steps then to increase adoption of laser vision correction among the general population, at least here in the U.S.?
Honestly, I think getting spokespeople, to get somebody who's admired by the various generations. You know, the boomers are too old for LASIK now.
True.
But to get people who are widely admired. Now, companies are a little afraid of that because the minute you pick a great spokesperson, they go off and do something terrible. They commit a felony, you know.
Or something.
I think it would be pretty safe, you know, picking certain individuals who have a track record of being good people. It's very powerful. As a matter of fact, at the ASCRS meeting, I noticed that one of the Jonas Brothers was in ads all over the place.
Oh yeah, for the ICL.
For the Evo ICL. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very powerful. That one of the Jonas Brothers. You know, I think we should do something like that. I really do, with multiple spokespeople.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In my own practice, a lot of times patients will say, "Oh, I know you did this celebrity, this Oscar winner surgery you did." And I was like, but that person, she doesn't know anything about ophthalmology. I did surgery on 70 fellow, I did cataract surgery for 70 fellow ophthalmologists. They know. That should mean far more. But no, the general population is more impressed with that woman who won the Oscar.
Yeah.
Chose you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really think we're missing a chance here. If the various societies chipped in with some of the big industry players, we could hire some great people.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of this story. I don't remember all the details. It was a little before my time. But how when the FDA went to approve IOLs, they had an actor who played a doctor on TV.
Yes.
Explaining it to them that he had the procedure done.
Yes, they had Robert Young, who played Marcus Welby.
Marcus Welby, MD.
And that was a long time ago. But you know, he had a huge impact.
Yeah.
At the time, he was the number one male TV star. And the senators just sat in awe, and he had a profound... he had no idea what he was talking about. You know, he was given a script written by real doctors, but he was profoundly moving, very influential, and, you know, it changed the way IOLs were treated by industry and by Congress.
Yeah. So maybe you've got, I actually like your insight there. Maybe we need to find a kind of a spokesperson who will help kind of get it more in the mainstream.
More than one.
Yeah.
I think it takes several.
Yeah.
And you know, so many of the stars have already had LASIK.
Yeah.
Just to get somebody who's happy and pay them to be a spokesperson, that would be very powerful.
Where do you think we're going with keratorefractive surgery versus lenticular surgery? So obviously in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, refractive cataract surgery has really come onto the scene. 20 years ago, it was almost unknown. But now it's far, far more common. Where do you think kind of we draw the line? Because now we have a spectrum of refractive possibilities. When you're very young, we can do either corneal refractive surgery, PRK, LASIK, Smile Now even. We can do a phakic IOL, like we talked about, the EvoVision ICL. We can then move along as when presbyopia hits, then we've got more options, and then obviously when it's time for lens replacement. Where do you think that's going to shift?
I think they will all coexist. I really think, you know, there are some people who will, due to their lifestyle, their hobbies, whatever, be more appropriate for one procedure than the other. But I don't think the ICL is going to, I know it's marching down into lower and lower myopia. It's not going to wipe out laser vision correction. Not at
sure.
all. It'll all coexist. I don't think there are too many people who would recommend the ICL for a minus 150.
Sure.
You know, I mean, they will always, always coexist. You know, just like now, there isn't one IOL. There isn't one
right.
phaco machine. There, I mean, you know.
So get more tools in the toolbox. You can treat basically a wider spectrum of people
exactly
and kind of
tailor
the treatment to the patient.
Exactly right. What's that old expression, to the man who has only a hammer, everything looks like a nail?
Yes.
Yeah?
Right.
You know, you have to have a lot of toys, and pick the one that's most appropriate for each patient.
Yeah, so I'm obviously crazy about ophthalmology, cataract, refractive surgery. So I always think that, gosh, we can move towards, yes, corneal refractive surgery when you're like early 20s. That'll tie you over to your like 50-ish. When you're 50-ish, you get IOL replacement surgery, refractive lens exchange, with hopefully at that time a truly accommodating IOL. And then as you shift in refractive error 10, 20, 30 years down the road, you can use that new, you know, refractive index shaping of the IOLs and keep adjusting the focusing of the eye, and you can have a lifetime of incredible vision.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah, 100%.
So it's just like, yeah, I think it's just, it'll be, I'm so excited for that.
Yeah. I think the people who are young now in their teens and early 20s will have so many wonderful things. They will never have to wear their glasses. Never. Really, they'll have a brilliant future.
Right. Another analogy, another surgeon gave me, which I thought was very interesting, says, he says, if you could only walk with crutches, wouldn't it be amazing if you do a procedure that you never need crutches again? And he says, what if the crutches were your glasses? You just never need them again. You don't need to put these plastic things on your face. And I was like, wow, just to think of it that way makes you wonder, like, yeah, why isn't this more common?
Yeah.
So speaking of our younger people, we have a lot of young ophthalmologists who just love this podcast. And you've had an incredible career. I mean, truly a pioneering career. You've mentored so many young people. What do you think are the important things now for a younger person to face or kind of focus on in that career path? You did something very smart, which is very focused on you want to be the at the cornea and refractive surgery of the cornea. So you're very modest. You didn't mention a lot of things. Like you were the first person also to do conductive keratoplasty. You're involved in this. You had a lot of firsts, not just the couple we mentioned. But I think one of the neat things is everything you do is just about that one really ultra-specialized part of ophthalmology.
Well, you've already pointed out pretty much what I think a young person should do. Find something, narrow your focus to something where you can excel.
Mm-hmm.
Find a mentor to help you. It really helps if you've done a fellowship. Stay in contact with your fellowship director, who you're with your mentor. A lot of people will finish a fellowship and then just disappear and never call back, hey, Dr. Smith, remember me? I graduated a year and a half ago. Do you have any projects I can help with? Can I be a co-investigator on your next project? Stay in contact with that mentor and ask for career advice along the way. But you have to really love the project that you've got, because when you drag yourself home at the end of a long day and you're exhausted and tired and all you really want to do is get a glass of wine, put your feet up and watch TV, to spend a few extra hours doing your research, analyzing data, etc., you have to love that project.
Yeah.
And have a very understanding spouse.
That's probably the more important part of the equation there, for sure.
But there's another thing. There are very few clinician scientists. One of them, I'm proud to say, is an ex-fellow of mine, Dr. Steve Wilson. He's at Cleveland Clinic. He spends half the week doing LASIK. He spends the other half of the week doing molecular biology research.
Wow.
In the lab with PhDs and postdocs. And he's got his life carved out. Now, how many people can do that? When you finish school, when you finish your training, usually you have six figures of debt.
Right.
You have a spouse who would like to get out of the studio apartment that you've been in for years.
Yeah.
And you might have a baby and one on the way. And are you going to take half the week to think great thoughts?
Yeah, no. It becomes tough.
You're going to start knocking out cases and making big bucks so that you can improve start saving for your kids' college. So, when I did all the eczema research, I spent an enormous amount of time doing it. But I was lucky. My dad was an orthopedic surgeon. I finished with no debt. I wasn't married. I had one mouth to feed, this one right here. And the fact that I didn't make a whole lot of money for years.
Didn't matter.
I loved what I was doing, and I could afford to do it. So there are one or two other clinician scientists. I brag about Steve Wilson all the time, and he lets me do it. There are one or two others I don't want to mention by name, but they have extraordinary circumstances. No debt, a spouse that makes a ton of money. It takes a lot to allow an MD to go off and do really basic research, seminal research. And I just hope more and more docs are able to do it. But even if they can't do it, to do clinical research moves the ball forward tremendously.
For sure.
To investigate which procedure, which drug is better. I mean, this changes the way we practice medicine every day.
There are a lot now in the last, let's say, 20 years of MD, PhD ophthalmologists. A lot more than in the past. Part of it is the U.S. started that MSTP, the Medical Scientist Training Program. So if you do an MD, PhD, all the 7 or 8 years of MD plus PhD combined, it's all free. So a lot of people certainly want to do that. It's very competitive. But you're right. Sometimes, though, the life gets in the way. They do this MD, PhD training, and I'd say more than half of the MD, PhDs who trained, did residency with us at UCLA, do zero with their PhD. They just go into practice and just get to work, and they're doing a ton of surgery. And again, they just got to focus on life.
Yeah.
So it's tough.
Yeah, it is very, very tough. You know, maybe we can think of a way around that in the future. But you know, there are some wonderful, wonderful examples. And, you know, one way to fight that is to increase the amount of money that people get on their NIH grant. If you're an MD now,
sure,
and you say you want to spend 50% of your time doing research on your NIH grant, they allow you to ask for a salary, but it's pitiful. It's pitiful. Oh. So if the amount of money you could put on your NIH grant made up for all the surgeries you could have done, all the office visits, then that would be a very reasonable thing, and a whole lot of people would do it.
Yeah, you'd encourage more research.
A whole lot of people would do it.
But if you set it up to be a financial hit, only people in extraordinary circumstances are probably going to be able to capitalize on that.
Exactly right, yeah.
I also loved your advice about find something you love to do. When people find out, like for cataract coach, today is video number 1,850. So I've done it every day for 1,850 days, never missing a day. And they're like, either you're crazy or you really love cataract surgery. And I'm like, probably a little bit of both.
Well, Uday, do you know, I've never met a cataract surgeon who doesn't use cataract coach.
Oh, you're too sweet.
No. Everybody, I use it. When I want to try something I've not done before, that's where I go. I use it all the time. And it doesn't matter what stage you are in your career. There are so many great videos voiced over by brilliant surgeons, mostly you, but lots of great surgeons from around the world. You can find anything on there. And you have all these years to scrub with residents and just handle the disasters with them in a cool, calm way. You know, that's why everybody admires you. That's why you got voted to the very top, because you deserve to be there.
Oh, you're too sweet. Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed the teaching of the residents. I did it for 22 years. I actually retired last year at age 52. I retired from teaching the residents. Yeah, it was just time to change gears, pass the baton to someone else who's a little bit younger and has, you know, I attended 10,000 resident cases, which is a pretty good number, and you know, gosh, I had countless anterior vitrectomies, so no matter what happened in the case, I know how to rescue it.
You know, when I was at LSU, the cornea fellows would show up on the first day, and some of them had been in the military doing cataract surgery for 10 years, so they're sitting there with gray hair, and they're doing a cornea fellowship. Others were right out of residencies. Some of the residencies did not allow them to do much surgery. Some were naturally gifted, some were not. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't care how old or young you are. I don't care where you trained. I don't care how many cases you've done. 6 months from now, all your cases will look exactly the same.
It's great.
No one,
I love it.
No one will know who's who did what. You will all be equally excellent 6 months from now. I will see to it. And they all were. They all were.
Oh, I love that.
Some people had to work a little harder to get there, but they all were the same in 6 months.
Oh, that's amazing. It's hard. That's much harder to do in today's academic environment. But I love the determination there.
Yeah, it is harder. Hats off to everybody who teaches, whether it's by video or in person. Hats off to the teachers.
Yeah, you know, the videos, that's how I learn more than I contribute by making those videos. In fact, years ago, when I wanted to learn DMEC, my residents, I was the county hospital, my UCLA residents, and they wanted to do DMEC, and I hadn't done it before. So I watched a ton of videos. I reached out to a couple of amazing surgeons. One was Veldman at University of Chicago, young guy who's a gifted surgeon. Another one was Martin Dierersamer from Austria. And I asked them for their videos. Can I host them on Cataract Coach, compile them all together? Because they make it look so easy. You put the graft in there, you tap the cornea a couple times, it's done. You get... It's so much harder than that.
Yes.
But by making videos of them and their secrets and their procedures, I kind of memorized everything. And then about 10 DMEC cases later, I was feeling great and I was able to teach the residents how to do it. But I guess I actually learned by video. No one taught me hands-on.
Yeah. And it's good when they don't edit out the tough parts.
Right.
You know, when they make it look really slick, that doesn't really help people as much as, oops, you know.
Right. Yeah, on Cataract Coach, some of my most popular videos are complete cataract cases where I show me operating a complete case start to finish. No edits, nothing. And you see everything as it comes, and sometimes it's me trying to three times get inside the paracentesis, something so basic that it's just, but still. And other ones that are very popular are the complications.
Yeah.
And so those are obviously, those are two big categories that people loved and they probably learned the most from.
Yeah. And there used to be, they don't do it anymore, thank God, but there used to be a live cataract surgery during AAO sponsored by one of the big companies.
I used to be a surgeon for. I've done live surgery at 20 meetings.
Well, my hat's off to you. We used to do it at LSU. We stopped because cameramen come in who don't know anything about sterile technique. Yeah. They get up in your face with bright lights. They touch the trays.
Oh no, we didn't do that. Yeah,
Terrible things happen.
Yeah,
there's extra stress on the surgeon. There's extra stress on the patient, who can hear all this noise and all this craziness. And there are lots of extra people in the room. So I doff my chapeau to you that you were able to do that. But mostly it was the cameraman contaminating everything that made us stop.
Yeah, so the ones that they always had really professional cameramen. But you're right. Some things are different in that you couldn't hold your instruments normally. You'd have to I'd have to put my chopper hand in a kind of supinated position so that they could get a camera angle over my hand so I didn't block the angles.
Yeah.
And to add more stress, you had two earpieces. You had in one ear the director telling you to stand on the camera, focus up, focus down, zoom out. And the other ear you had the moderator in the audience who was asking you questions. And hopefully the moderator was asking you about the step you were doing as opposed to you're doing the Rexes and then the person's asking you about the IOL.
Yeah.
Which my brain can't handle. I can't chew gum and walk at the same time sometimes. So I'll keep it simple. But you're right. Yeah, that's not so popular anymore. Obviously, those have kind of tapered down. There are other countries where it's still done. I just was in Brazil last week for the Brazilian Cataract Refractive Meeting, and they had a big live study session, which I was able to be one of the moderators of. What an amazing time. But there's a lot to learn there, and there were complications. There was an Argentinian flag sign. There was this. But you're right. It is added stress for the surgeon, the patient, etc. But obviously, lots to learn.
Yes, indeed.
But I think that's the way we're going too now. It's like even another set of popular videos for me is people ask me, "Can you show LASIK videos?" So I've got a handful of LASIK videos online.
Oh, I've seen them. Oh yeah, I've seen them. Yeah.
I should probably put up more of those, but I guess they're not. LASIK is such a safe procedure. I don't have any complication videos from LASIK.
But people have to learn how to do it.
No, but I don't have any of the complications. So I can't even think of the last time I had a complication from a LASIK case.
Oh, there used to be horrific complications before the femto.
Oh, before with the microkeratome?
Oh. People are forgetting to put in the foot plate, and all of a sudden the cut goes into the anterior chamber and opens the capsule.
What?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, I've never seen that. So the keratome blade ends up entering the limbus, entering the AC, hitting the lens capsule.
And tearing up the iris usually, too.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. See, things like that can't happen anymore with the femto. The worst thing that ever happened in my professional career, do I have the time to tell you?
Yeah, wait, as much time as you want.
So the worst thing, knock on wood, so far, the worst thing that's ever happened to me was before the femto, I was doing LASIK with a brand new microkeratome that I bought at the Academy, and I liked it because it was called the Innovatome. It had these huge brass walls that kept out eyelashes.
Mm.
So the kiss of death back then was that an eyelash would flip into your track and ruin the flap. So I was using it, and I used it all day, and everything was going great. It had a design flaw, though, that I didn't know about, and it was removed from the market a week or two later because disasters were happening all over the country. And the problem was the foot plate, which always went in on these microkeratomes, you heard a click.
Mm-hmm.
It clicked in upside down or right side up.
Oh.
So all the microkeratomes were designed so that you could only click it in one way.
Sure.
So on the last case of the day, my very tired technician clicks it in upside down. I make the pass. I look down. There's aqueous coming out of the center of the cornea.
Oh, my goodness.
So she was minus eight. Actually, let me go back. I make the pass and I start the ablation and I see aqueous. I actually got through, it's been a while since I talked about this case, I got through 94% of her ablation before I saw aqueous. I did not realize the flap was too thick. It flipped mm-hmm. back, it reflected. So I close it and I talk to her and her husband and I said, I'm not sure why this happened, but the flap is too thick. And some fluid came out of the eye, and we're going to see her tomorrow. I pressure patched it the next day. It was a mess. I had to suture it. I should have sutured it then, but I didn't sure. have any sutures. I didn't have a suture tray with me in the laser center. The next day I was prepared. I sutured it. And I'll make a long story short. I said, hang in there. Topography-guided ablations are coming. I took out the sutures. She ended up minus 14 plus 8 at 75, best corrected 2060. This is scarred into my brain. I remember those numbers.
Yeah.
So we're waiting and waiting. And she said, Dr. McDonald, I'm sick of waiting. I'm sick of waiting. So I call Julian Stevens in London. And I said, Julian, we finished the clinical trial here for wavefront guided ablations. You've got one, though, at Moorfields. Can I fly my patient over there? Can you do a wavefront guided ablation on this poor lady? I paid for her and her sister out of my own pocket to fly to London. I put them in a very fine hotel, the Marriott Courtyard, right near Moorfields. I said, I'll pay for everything, Julian, fix her. So he called me and he said, Marguerite, we can't handle that. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna do basically clear lens extraction. And I'm going to make her hyperopic. I have an IOL that will correct almost all 14 diopters of astigmatism. And we'll make her hyperopic so that when we come back and do wavefront treatments, all the shots will be in the periphery and far away from the perf.
Sure.
So he did a brilliant job. She comes back to me. We wait 3 months. It was amazing. I mean, they have IOLs. IOLs were outside the United States that we just don't have.
Yeah.
So she flies back, and at this point she was like plus two, minus one at 80 degrees, and she was about 20/40, best corrected. He does a wavefront-based ablation. She ends up 20/25 plus two without correction.
Wow.
And I sent her and her sister twice. Julian was very gracious. He said, I'm not going to give you a bill for Moorfields. You've already paid countless thousands. She's 20/25 plus two without correction after two trips to England. And she looks at me and says, Dr. McDonald, when are you going to do my other eye?
Wow, I love it. Because she knows how much you care. You care so deeply about her.
So this is a long time ago. I used up all my Marriott miles, I used up all my Amex miles, and another $25,000. This was a long time ago.
Yeah.
That would be like, about $100,000 here. But she knew I would take a bullet for her. She knew I would do anything for her. And when I got tears in my eyes when she asked me, when are we going to do my second eye?
That's amazing. It's such an amazing story.
By the way, her second eye I did as a PRK.
Yeah, no flap needed. Well, that begs the question. In today, where we are today with technology, how do you decide PRK, LASIK? What's your preference?
Well, you're going to think I changed because of her. I did not. But I've gone back after years and years and years of doing mostly LASIK. I've gone back to doing 100% PRK. I have a perioperative regimen. They don't have any pain. They walk in the next day with white eyes, and they're usually at least 20/25 the next day, even though they still have a defect, an epithelial defect that's closing. But my perioperative regimen, I've taken years to perfect it. It's just wonderful. They don't.
Can you give us some insight? I want a copy.
I will be glad to send it to you. I'll be glad to send it to anybody. The heart of it, well, first I use the EpiClear device to remove the epithelium, which is designed in Israel. It's this fantastic disposable item, no moving parts, single use. But it scoops up the epithelium and it leaves basement membrane. You think, why is that important? You're going to shoot it off anyway. Well, in the periphery, it leaves basement membrane, so the epithelium rushes in much faster. So I use the EpiClear. But probably the key to success is to give them a neurosurgical dose of oral steroids 20 minutes before the case. So if they're otherwise healthy, they're not diabetic, they get 80 milligrams of prednisone exactly 20 minutes before the laser fires, not 30, not 40. I've studied the timing. And then the next day, they get 80. So it's 80, 80, 40, 20, 10, 5, and then they're off. And I give them the equivalent of Zantac, you know, something to protect their stomach, sure. BID for that whole time. A huge slug. By the way, I give everybody, except for brittle diabetics, everybody gets IV steroids after cataract surgery, after everything. Steroids are the key to no pain. And for dead quiet eyes the next day.
So even IOL surgery, you're giving IV steroids? Like what dose? What are we giving?
So I usually give 100 of IV Sayu Cortef.
Okay.
So they get IV push, and I'm studying right now whether it should be at the very beginning of the case, the middle, the end. It doesn't seem to matter. But they come in the next day, and their eyes are dead quiet. And, you know, there was a study done by the Amidrios people. It's not well known, but 35% of cataract patients complain bitterly of pain within the first 48 hours. And we don't seem to recognize that. I guess a lot of us have our patients seen by optometrists or cornea fellows or whatever. But, man, they have no pain. And, you know, if you do a pterygium, usually they're in agony.
Sure.
They're in agony. Mm-mm. Not if you give them a massive IV dose of Sayu Cortef while they're around the table. They come in the next day smiling. Did you take any Vicodin? No. I mean, it's just a game changer for ocular pain. Now, obviously, you know, if you have a well-controlled type 2 diabetic, you can give them, I usually consult with the anesthesiologist exactly what the dose would be, and sometimes I have to skip it. You have somebody...
Sure.
A labile diabetic, type 2 or type 1, skip it. But whenever I can, I do it. And it's magical oral steroids, high dose, magical for surface ablation.
So then what are you doing in your post-op regimen? Are you using mitomycin intraop?
No, only if the ablation is greater than 75 microns. And then if I do use it, it's only for 15 seconds because longer than that, you have to come up with a whole new algorithm.
Sure.
But so other things I do, of course, antibiotics, et cetera. I do give them Acuvail. I allow them to use Acuvail.
So that's Ketorolac, preservative-free.
Preservative-free, right. But the other key to success, and this is from David Gartry of St. Thomas in London. He published a paper about 25 years ago, showing that 0.1% tetracaine, preservative-free, if you give it to a surface ablation patient and you let them take it up to every hour while awake for the first 3 days, it doesn't slow re-epithelialization at all, and it helps.
So 1/10 the normal dose, then, basically.
1/10 of 1% they get to take it home. So I order that. Now, I have to say, I might back off on that because the oral steroids.
Just so good.
Gartry didn't use the massive dose of oral steroids with the rapid taper. But, yeah, my patients are comfortable, and they tell their friends they're comfortable. And, you know.
And then bandage contact lens for a couple days?
Yeah, yes, they definitely get a bandage contact lens. What I will do, and of course, if they're tiny, if they're 116 pounds or less, I start with 60, 60, 60, 30, 15, 10, 5 off. But I'd be glad to send you my regimen, and you can stick it on Cataract Coach.
There's a lot to learn there. Honestly, be happy to feature that, for sure.
My pleasure.
Wow, that's neat stuff. So you switched completely away. So no femto LASIK for you at all, no smile, just basically surface ablation.
Right. And you know what? It's a wonderful life. You can't have a flap complication if you don't have a flap. Now, you can make a gorgeous flap, and then the patient rubs their eyes and they come in the next day and the flap is hanging, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can be the best surgeon in the world and still have a significant flap complication, even in 2023. But not if you don't have a flap.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. And not much issue with haze then. So you said as long as the ablation is 75 microns or less, you don't end up seeing stromal haze?
No, but I will say there's some regional differences, like the surgeons in Saudi Arabia or the surgeons in Mexico. The closer you are to the equator, the more aggressive you have to be about mitomycin.
Sure.
The more ultraviolet light they get. Yeah. So, you know, if I worked in it, but this works in New York. It works in New York.
Are you doing anything else like vitamin C afterwards, things of this nature, or not really?
Yeah. Oh? Oh, yeah. They take big doses of vitamin C. I'm going to send it to you.
We'll make a video out of it.
The patient is very busy. They're doing lots of stuff, but the doctor isn't busy. The doctor just gives them the sheet and tells them what to do. It costs me about $60 a bottle to make the little vial of they can't overdose on it. There's not enough.
Sure.
I think it's just 3 cc's, but most of them throw it away. They don't use much, but it's nice for them to have it as an escape, just in case.
As a rescue med, let's say.
Right. Yeah, rescue med. Yeah.
And what's the most you'll do on an ablation? What's your high end?
Ooh. Or
does it depend on the patient, the anatomy, the pupil size?
It depends on a lot of things, but I wouldn't go over -8. I wouldn't.
Got it.
Bad things start to happen. Then you do start to get haze. And even though the ablation profiles are great now, you start to get some optical aberrations.
Image quality issues, sure.
Terrible, yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't go above -8. Then it's time to go do the Evo, you know? I mean...
Yeah, right. That's what you said. Have a spectrum of surgical options so you can offer kind of everything to your patient population.
Yeah.
Well, that's such great pearls here. Well, we definitely have to do the Cataract Coach video for PRK or surface ablation and your regimen, because I think there's a lot to learn there. And I think it's an easy way for a lot of surgeons who don't, you know, currently do keratorefractive surgery. It's an easy way to get into it.
And I will tell you, if you do one LASIK a year, it's dangerous. If you do one PRK a year, you will do a great job. It's great for somebody who's starting. It's great for a lower volume refractive surgeon. You really, you know, with the trackers, with everything today, you just can't really get in trouble. You really can't.
Right.
And I have often told the big companies, why don't you have weekend PRK courses? You know, a lot of the premium channel IOL patients are unhappy because the surgeon missed Plano.
Right, there's a residual refractive error.
You know?
Clean it up.
Teach doctors how to do it. It's a weekend course how to do PRK. Nobody wants to do that. I think that's an opportunity there that has been missed.
Well, then you know what? We have to do a Cataract Coach PRK series then.
There you go.
we'll teach it with videos anyway.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Marguerite. I want to say thanks. What an incredible podcast. I really enjoyed talking to you. The history of how the excimer laser was basically developed still blows my mind, of how many kind of serendipitous things had to happen just for this to go through. And I really want to commend you on what you've done in this field. It's so amazing. And if you don't know, if you ever see Margarita at a meeting, you can absolutely go up to her and ask for advice. You are the kindest person I know in this field.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So. That touches me. Thank you, Uday.
All right, guys.
Have a wonderful evening.
And thank you. And then next podcast is coming up. As you know, now we're doing Cataract Coach Podcast every single week. And you know I'm not going to miss a week. So check it out next time.
Thanks, Uday. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Wow, that was great. Thank you, Dr. McDonald. I learned so much from this podcast. And I want to thank you guys for listening to it. I trust that you enjoyed it and also learned quite a lot. We're going to have the full recipe of her cocktail for the PRK patients, even the cataract patients, on our cataractcoach.com website. I want to encourage you to also download our podcast, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcast from. Subscribe, search for Cataract Coach, search for my name. It'll all come up. That way you can enjoy it while you're exercising or driving to work. And we'll see you next week for yet another episode. Remember, we're doing these every single week. See you soon.